This is Carmen DeFalco on ESPN 1000, Chicago's home for sports. Thanks for listening to the Carmen and Yurko podcast, presented by Coors Light. Stay inside and buy your Coors Light online. Find out how at get.coorslight.com. Coors Light, take time to chill.
This is Chicago's home for sports, ESPN 1000.
This is the home of Carmen and Yurko.
Follow us on the gram at Carmen and Yurko and at ESPN underscore Chicago.
The only thing that disappointed me about The Last Dance, 10 episodes, 5 weeks, is all this Michael Scott Burrell stuff I was promised. What happened? I mean, that was it? So he busted Scott Burrell's chops a lot. I mean, I thought there was going to be some really nasty stuff, you know?
Cutting room floor, kid. Cutting room floor.
I don't know.
Remembers what he actually said to him, and what he actually said and what they put in were two different things.
Maybe you're right.
A lot of stuff that was probably left out.
He did have creative control, after all. Yeah. But Michael was never going to agree to do it without, so I can get over it, you know. I think Ken Burns was a little upset, but I guess Ken Burns walked back some of those comments. But I can get over it. Get off your high horse, you know. All right, we needed this, for crying out loud. It was fun, so Michael had final say in creative control. All right, I thought Jason Hare did a really nice job. He's a great storyteller himself. He's been fabulous with Waddle and Sylvie every Monday, and he's going to come on one more time today. I think 3 o'clock, is that right, guys? Yeah, 3 o'clock today with Waddle and Sylvie. So a couple hours from now to recap everything. It's Carmen and Yurko. We're on Twitch, twitch.tv. Check us out, ESPN 1000 Chicago. Yurko was on last night. How'd it go last night, kid, previewing the final week? Yeah,
it was fine, yeah.
Good.
Adam Abdallah got me all set up to where I just had to push the one button. Then I had to choose a category, and there I was.
That's it, man, yeah.
And I was on. I had no idea I was on, whatever. I sat and talked about the time I met Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
And it was good stuff.
You've been saving that story or what?
No, I never told it. It never came up for any reason whatsoever.
How could that be all these years in the media? Tell it in case everybody wasn't paying attention on Twitch last night. Shame on you. And then I want to get more into the rebuild and what
it's going to be the quickly abridged version. I was playing down in Jacksonville. I signed with Jacksonville in April of 96. So I had gone down there. We had some practices. We might have even had a little weekend thing, a veterans thing where they had the new free agents in. And we stayed, and on Sunday, I flew out of there on Sunday. Well, it was April 14th, 1996. The Bulls were playing the Cavaliers, and they were going to win, and they were going to go 69-9 in 1996. I flew up to Chicago at Midway, and I was getting picked up by King Air, who was going to take me, and I was going to sign a bunch of autographs heading back north with guys that I've done some autograph shows with back then. So I'm waiting there, and the guy goes, oh, hey, by the way, the Bulls are going to come in. Your guy's about an hour away. He goes, the Bulls are coming back from Cleveland. I'm like, oh, great. I'm watching TV, April 14th, 1996. You remember what was happening that day?
April of 1996?
Yeah.
April 1996.
Greg Norman was
blowing the lead at the Masters?
On Sunday, he had the 6-shot lead. He was blowing the lead, so I was watching it. One of the first Bulls through the door was Jordan. And he goes, what's going on in the Masters? What's going on in the Masters? Then I'm the guy telling him he's blowing it. He had a 6-shot lead. They're even right now, and he's about to go another one down. He's bogeying this hole.
Were you
and it
floored?
Might have been the ninth.
Were you floored, though? I mean, like, Michael Jordan just came up to you and said.
I mean, it wasn't only because I've been playing in the NFL.
Yeah.
And I've been playing with Marino and a bunch of different people and rubbing shoulders with the greats and stuff like that. So they said the Bulls are coming, so you prepare yourself for the Bulls. The only guy I actually talked to was Paxson.
I remember you telling me this.
And I introduced myself and talked to him. That's the first time I ever met Pax. Said who I was and who I was playing with now. I was with Green Bay. I'm heading back up there. I was down in Jacksonville. So we sat and we talked a little bit of golf. And he was excited, and he couldn't believe that Norman was blowing it, and this and that. And then Harper walked in, Pip walked in. Everybody walked in just for a little bit. Wennington could have even been there. And they all walked out, and they got out of Dodge.
How about that?
It was probably total 5 minutes.
Pax was a coach on the staff at that point.
Yeah. I got picked up by my plane. They flew me back up. I signed about 300 autographs for those guys. And boom, everybody was hunky-dory.
Isn't that something? Yurko's brush with greatness. Wow.
But only because of the day. And the only reason I'd ever say Jordan would remember that because it's with a historic sporting event. Mm-hmm. It was the collapse, and he was coming back from Cleveland. So you can't not remember that. Yeah, I ducked in. Yes, I was watching it, and I was the guy that gave him the information. So that's not bad.
That's,
I got that.
That's real good.
Me.
Yeah, are you kidding me?
$2 gets me a cup of coffee.
Yeah, well, yeah. $2.50 maybe.
Yeah, a little bit more. Depends how big you want it, Carmen.
If you are a Dunkin' Perks app.
I know how big you like it, Carmen.
Yes, of course.
And your coffee.
And my coffee. If you are a Dunkin' Perks app, you get free coffee on Wednesday. So, you know, you got that going for you.
Next two Wednesdays.
The next two. All right. Yeah. That's the next two Wednesdays. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Merck. Dotting the I's and crossing the T's, my man. I heard you take
it. By the way,
giving Merck a little grief on the Twitch.
Yeah, I was going to say on Twitch. Too, I mean, yeah. I was the one who put the question out there. Who's your favorite ESPN 1000 teammate? And he does a nice thing for Carm, of course. And he says him and Waddle are very simpatico. NFL.
Because we share two professions, DeGrette.
Right. And then he's like, Danny, I can tolerate. And then he says something like, and by the way, Yurko, I'm watching on my TV. You know, we can get Twitch on my TV. So big screen TV, watching it myself. Beth, two kids. And he's like, I don't really don't care if Merkin goes in the middle of the street in traffic or something like that.
Yeah, Michigan, State Street.
Yeah. And everyone's like, whoa. All my family's like, whoa, what's that? I thought you helped Yurko out all the time. And I'm like, apparently not.
That's how Yurko shows his love, though, truly.
That's it.
So just remember
that. You're not getting your chops busted by me. You're not being loved by me.
I know. Yeah, I know.
Remember that. But I did say something nice eventually.
Yeah, you did.
I'd love to use him as a golf club.
Oh, God, real nice. I would encourage everyone to go read Casey Johnson's story that he posted, I think either late last night or early this morning, at NBCSports.com. And it's Jerry Krause explains why the Bulls dynasty unraveled in his own words. And in the final excerpt from Jerry Krause's unfinished and unpublished memoir, remember Jerry had passed, the Bulls general manager pulls back the curtain on the end of the dynasty. You can read all this transcript, word for word, from what Krause had said about the end of the dynasty. And he basically, I can kind of give you like an abridged version if I can.
Give it to
here.
Me.
Because it's pretty long.
Read the whole thing, Carl.
I'm not going to do that. He says, I'll take you to no other place, to no place that any Bulls outsider's ever been to. A meeting back in early July of 98. It was attended by Jerry Reinsdorf, myself. Remember, this is Krause. Right. Assistant GM Jim Stack, Al Vermeil, the team's doctors and surgeons, the VP of finance, Irwin Mandel, who is a great guy, by the way, and assistant to the GM, Karen Stack. Karen's one of the coaches now. Vermeil knew more about the condition of the players' bodies than the medical people. He had continually tested them in and out of the season during the entire championship run. We had asked then-trainer Chip Schaefer to submit a written report on the team's health. Phil had made the decision to leave 8 months before the meeting, so he still kind of takes a little dig at Phil, right? He can't help himself. The first question I asked, how much did people think we can get out of Luke Longley, a free agent-to-be who had to rest periodically over the last few years because of unstable ankles? Al and the doctors thought he was going to break down quickly. Next question, Rodman. Every person in the room was concerned that Dennis's off-court meanderings had caught up with him and that he was playing on fumes at the end of that season. Okay, no center, no power forward, very little cap space to sign anybody of any quality to replace them. Who defends in the middle if Jordan and Pippen do come back? Who rebounds? We go to Pippen. He's had two major surgeries in 2 years, one of them late in the summer to purposely defy our instructions to do it either... and not miss the regular season time. He wants to rightfully be paid superstar dollars. Is he worth the risk, especially if we can't find a center and a power forward and he and Michael have to carry the load for a new coach? I seriously doubted that. Can Michael continue his greatness without a center, a power forward, maybe without Pippen? Could Bill Russell, the greatest team player ever, have won without those great players around him? The important role players like Steve Kerr and Judd Bushler are free agents. They can get more money from other teams under the cap rules. Could we get Phil to coach without a proven center, power forward, probably Pippen? Basically a new bench, crazy expectations that in Michael we trust. Can we win with all of that? Not a chance. Put yourself in those shoes as we walk out of that room. What would you do? Did we break up a dynasty, or was the dynasty breaking up of age, natural attrition of NBA players with little time to recuperate, and the salary cap rules that govern the game? It kind of goes on and on. Again, I'm not going to read the whole thing because there's a lot in there, and people can go back and check it out for themselves. But that was Jerry's summation. Hey, it's not my fault. We were getting old. The cap was changing. There is some truth to what Jerry is saying there. I mean,
they've gone about the business of undermining this team from the get-go. You know, they went out, and whether he had said it, they were going to break it up in 97 or not, you know, and whatever discussions were being had between Pippen and his agents and whatever, they had gone about the business, especially Jerry Krause, of alienating this team. And begrudgingly, they came back in 98. And Phil Jackson was the last guy in 97, 98. He was the last guy to agree. He was the last guy to be in on it. And he was told that this is it. There's not going to be a next year. So they've, in essence, kind of muddied the waters for everybody. They've ticked everybody off, and they've pissed everybody off. And now they all came back behind one common theme to go ahead and make a charge, to make a stand, to go get that second three-peat. You know, nobody's ever done a second three-peat, even though they won eight in a row down in Boston.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so off of all of that, it would be damn near impossible to go ahead and try to put it all back together again.
Yeah.
It's like finishing a puzzle, seeing it, getting the championship. It's all complete. The final piece is in. Then somebody comes and just crumbles it up and throws it on the floor and says, hey, we're going to do it again. But there's no guarantee all the pieces are going to be in the puzzle. And we want you to go ahead and do it. But you might be 10 pieces short by the end of it all.
That's a difficult task.
Yes, it's impossible. They poisoned the waters. That's the way it was. There was never going to be a 98-99 campaign. Jerry Krause made sure of it. And in essence, so did Reinsdorf. And some would say it was a smart, business-savvy move. But you've had 22 years of garbage since then. Except for 1 year, maybe 2 years, when you had Derrick Rose. When he was healthy.
That's true. Had Jerry not been so adversarial through all these years, Yerk, or through all those years, I should say, it would have been a lot easier for Bulls fans to accept, right? I mean, you could have maybe understood the logical, reasonable arguments that he was trying to make. But he was so adversarial. He was so, you know, he wanted so badly to be loved and adored.
He would never be the face of any franchise or any corporation in the history of the world ever. Nobody would say, put this guy out and make him the face of our place. We want him talking and representing what we have going on. That would never happen in modern day America. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I do.
He would never be the mouthpiece.
He didn't look
five
the part.
Foot
he
two.
Didn't, right, yeah.
He was 2 inches shorter, and he would have been a perfect circle.
Right.
And he mumbled. And he bumbled, and he did what he did. And there's no way in the world you'd say, boy, that's the guy I want representing my corporation out in the front. Get him a microphone, put him out, and let him brand. He'll be our brand and our messaging. No, nobody will do that nowadays. They're smarter.
He was the very easy target, and then he made some very bad mistakes. And we'll tell you about some of those coming up next. We can also take your calls. Do you think the Bulls together would have still pulled off something amazing in 1999, would they even have been able to all stay together? Probably very unlikely when you think about the fine details of what was happening in the league at that time coming out of the 98 season. 312-332-3776 for Carmen and Yurko.
Carmen and Yurko.
Hello there.
Weekdays, noon to 2 on ESPN 1000. Chicago's home for sports.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hope everyone had a good weekend. Boy, the rain yesterday, my goodness gracious.
Incessant.
I mean, it didn't stop by me from about 10 o'clock Saturday night until 8:30, 8 o'clock or so maybe yesterday. Did not stop raining for 1 second.
I believe you, brother.
It was terrible. But at least Saturday was beautiful. Hope everyone enjoyed The Last Dance. It's Last Dance Monday with Carmen and Yurko on ESPN 1000, presented by Coors Light. Waddle and Sylvie follow. We're going to crosstalk with the guys in about 45 minutes or so, about 40 minutes. And they've got Jason Hare, the great director, coming up at 3. So this is when a rebuild goes wrong, right? Okay, you hire Tim Floyd. Tim Floyd really wants you to draft Steve Francis. Jerry Krause liked big guys. We know that, right, Yurk? So, of course, he doesn't draft Steve Francis. He drafts Elton Brand, number one overall. Tim Floyd quickly likes Elton Brand very, very much. What's not to like? Elton was solid on both ends of the floor. Young kid came out. People always bagged Duke back then, remember? And everybody was like, oh, yeah. Elton Brand can play. Averaged 20 and 10 his first two seasons, right?
I think Bobby Hurley and Leitner preceded him into the league and didn't really do well. Grant Hill was the Dukie that did very well.
Yeah, Grant Hill was exceptional. Yeah.
Johnny Dawkins was a solid ball player.
Yeah, solid, I guess. Yeah.
Solid
poor,
ball.
Poor player. Bobby Hurley got hurt. You know, you never car got that car accident. You never really know. So then the 2000 draft happens. And in fairness, it was not a very good draft. If you go back and look at it.
Yeah, Jingy Jop or whatever his name was.
No, that was 01. I'm not even there yet.
Okay.
The 2000 draft, if you go back in history and you look at it, it wasn't very good. Michael Redd, I think, in terms of just pure value over replacement, is the greatest player to come out of that draft. And Michael Redd was a fine player and pretty good scorer for a little while. But that'll tell you about, for whatever reason, it was just a bad year. So can I say, well, the Bulls had some totally egregious misses as far as like a player that went after some of their selections that turned out to be great? Not really, but the 2000 draft was bad for a few reasons. First of all, the Bulls had three first-round picks, and they walked away from that draft with Marcus Fizer, Jamal Crawford, who's by far the best out of all this group, but achieved great success when he left the Bulls, and Dalibor Bagaric. That was the first-round pick they acquired from San Antonio the year earlier in the Kerr deal. I covered these teams. I have pretty intimate detail of these teams. I love Dalibor as a guy. He couldn't have been nicer. Spoke perfect English. Loved Yurko. He would listen to Mac Yurko and Harry all the time. Absolutely loved Yurko because he knew Yurko was a Croatian. I mean, just a super likable guy that couldn't play, let's face it. So those are your three first-round picks, right? Then the infamous summer of 2001 happens. Krauss loves Pau Gasol. Atlanta was picking ahead of the Bulls that year, picking third. The Grizzlies on draft day trade, they agree for that deal with the Hawks. They sent Sharif Abdul-Rahim to Atlanta for the rights to Pau. So Pau's not there. The Bulls draft Eddie Curry. And then they famously trade Elton Brand to the Clippers for Tyson Chandler. Tim Floyd is irate. He wants to sort of quit on the spot. Jerry Krause calls Tyson Chandler and Eddie Curry into his office, and he says, you're the next Kevin Garnett. You're the next Shaquille O'Neal. You remember the numbers they gave him? Everybody remember their jersey numbers?
Yeah, 2 and 3.
2 and 3.
2 and 3 they gave him.
Those are the jersey numbers. 2 and 3. They put them next to each other real conveniently on all the billboards and on
Remember
the pocket
that?
Schedule.
Yeah.
2 and 3. And the rest is history. It's a debacle. So coming out of the dynasty, you had records of 13-37 in the lockout year, 17-65, and 15-67. Now you're going on year four, and you're turning it over to Eddie Curry, who's 19. You're telling him he's the next Shaquille O'Neal. Tyson Chandler, who's 19, you're telling him he's the next Kevin Garnett. Jamal Crawford, who was 21. Marcus Fizer, who was 23 and didn't have much of a work ethic. They reacquired Charles Oakley that year. Charles Oakley hated being here. He ripped Krause at every turn. He'd say things to us in the media like, don't ask me why I'm here. I didn't want to come here. They traded for me. I didn't sign here. He'd say this to us. I didn't sign as a free agent here. He ripped and undermined Tim Floyd whenever he had a chance. He famously went on a tirade early in the year when they were in Milwaukee, and Tim Floyd did a 5 for 5. You know, he didn't like the start. He subbed out all 5 starters, Yurk. He put in 5 bench guys. Oakley went off afterwards. He absolutely eviscerated him. And then the Bulls find him. They find him like $50,000 because he was killing Tim Floyd and he was making fun of him. He wanted nothing to do with it. The Bulls get off to a 4-21 start, and they've got to fire Tim Floyd. This was your master plan. This is why it only continued to look worse. And what people were thinking and feeling at that time, of this is what the dynasty was broken up for?
Yes.
This?
That's exactly it.
And so Jerry was so eager to say, I'll prove to all of you, I'm going to do it. I can do it. Trust me. 4 years later, you're still winning 15, 17 games. You've got 19-year-old kids that have no work ethic, no real veteran leadership around to take them under their wing, to show them how to be a pro, and it was a disaster.
And nobody was there to tell Jerry Krause to get back into his office and keep eating donuts.
Well,
and the 2 and 3 on both of those young kids' jerseys and putting them next to each other and using that on the schedule and or the logo or whatever they were going to do in their billboard advertising was a middle finger to Michael Jordan. That's exactly what it was. So when it all capsized on him and all went bad, that's why nobody gives a rat's patootie about Jerry Krause. Now, I don't care if his feelings were hurt.
I mean, when that's all you've got to show 4 or 5 years after, that's why there's still
this. When did
they
get Khalid El-Amin and Jake Voskel?
He was in those early 2000s. I mean, they were second-round picks. in the early 2000s. Yeah.
Those are great drafts, Carm.
Yeah, they were pretty bad.
You're right. Jamal Crawford, 1 out of 3, though. Marcus Pfizer was horrendous.
Total bum. Yes.
I can't believe how horrendous he was.
Yeah, he was bad. And he lit up the tournament that year. They made that run to the Elite Eight, and everybody was excited, and he was, you know, Floyd's guy, and he was no good. See, Red Fred is on ESPN 1000. What's up, Freddie?
Oh, Carmen, Yurko, you guys are the best. I love listening to you every
day. Freddie.
Good to talk to you.
What's up, bud?
Hey, two really quick things about the mistakes Kraus made. He made two massive mistakes that people don't talk about that much. Number one, he drafted Jason Caffey one pick ahead of Michael Finley in 95.
Yep.
That would have mitigated a ton of issues with the lack of young talent we had in 98. I think Michael would have been more likely to stay, even if Pippen walked, if you had a player like Finley on the roster. Number two, you just referred to it in the 2001 draft. All he had to do was draft Jason Richardson, who was picked fifth in that draft, was a fantastic player. Richardson and Brand would have been fantastic as a core in the East. Brand didn't win in the West because the West was a buzzsaw at the time, but he still was. His number is going to be retired with the Clippers someday. Wait and see. I love the doc, but I have a major problem with one issue, and I'd like to get your opinion on this.
Sure.
It has to do with Tony Kukoc. So the Pacers were properly depicted as our best competition in the East. I agree with that. They had a legitimate closer in Miller. They were a great team. In Game 7, Kukoc shoots 7-11. He had 21 points. He was completely ignored. It wasn't even mentioned.
Well, I thought they at one point, didn't they? Didn't somebody specifically say about what a great first half? Tony, like, Michael struggled in that first half, and Tony had a good first half. I thought there was one little note about it. Wasn't there, Fred?
Not in the Indiana Game 7. And it was Tony in the third quarter who kept us afloat. Pippen was 6-18. My son watched the doc, and he was left with the impression that, you know, Pippen was more impactful in that game. Tony Kukoc was arguably the MVP of that game. He had 21 points on 7-11 shooting. He was huge. And you ask any Pacer about it. I even hear Jalen Rose still talking about how great Tony Kukoc was in a game. He didn't even get a mention. I thought it was inexcusable. I just thought the way he was covered in this series was just ridiculous.
He's not sexy enough, I guess. I sort of agree with you there, Freddie. I felt like there should have been more of Tony. Fred, thanks for checking in, by the way. That we love C-Red Fred. Tony's not as sexy for the 9th and 10th episodes, I guess, Yurk. It's all about Michael and Scotty at that point. And Steve Kerr, obviously, his storyline was a big part of it because they're taking you through the game-winning shot in 97. But
they did show the pass to Tony, though, that Steve Kerr threw. It hit the back of Tony and then went out of bounds. They did show that path play,
though.
Yeah, they showed that play. Yeah, wonderful. Thank you.
We love Tony.
By the way, Elton Brand with the Clippers averaged 20.3 points.
Yeah.
20.3 points. And he averaged 10 rebounds. So he is a 2010 guy in his career with the L.A. Clippers.
Elton was a really good player. There's no doubt about it. And had they drafted better, had they not been so quick to just move on from him, they had this crazy vision about Tyson and Eddie. They thought that this is the direction of the league now, all these young players. And to a certain extent, it more so has become that. But back then, it was still kind of a gamble. It was still a risk. And unfortunately, they just weren't ready to play. And they really didn't have the support system around to help them. That was another big part of the problem. That's why Pax kept going out when he took over, trying to bring back Scotty. So Scotty could try to teach him a thing or two. Bring Antonio Davis. You know, Sylvia and I used to argue about Antonio Davis. I'd say they're trying to find some veteran player that can teach these guys, that can show them this is what you have to do to play in this league. It's not easy. Just because you dominated in high school doesn't mean you're going to dominate at this level. And those were hard lessons that those players learned, and they just had no success early on. To Tyson's credit, he's carved out a nice career for himself. But it never fired with Eddie. And, yeah, who could forget the Jason Caffey over Michael Finley? Kraus didn't ever think Michael Finley, he didn't think he could shoot. That's what I had always heard. He didn't think he could shoot the ball.
Yeah.
And plus they still had Michael. It's kind of like the Clyde Drexler thing, you know. It was like they had Michael, and so he didn't want to wait. He loved power forwards. That's what Jerry wanted. So he went out and he drafted Jason Caffey instead. Valancourt's in the city. What's up, Valancourt?
Hey, how you guys doing, man?
What's up, man?
Hey, I'm not calling to trash these Jerry guys, man, but they were wrong because if the Patriots build around Brady for all those years, these guys could have built around Michael, man. You don't let Michael walk out the door like that. You don't let the number one basketball player in the world walk out the door and you didn't, you know what I'm saying? You can't win a championship everywhere every year, man. They just didn't try. You see what I'm saying? They committed the crime of the century.
All right. Thanks, Valancourt.
Yeah, they dismantled the championship team. They dismantled it. Now, Reinsdorf, realizing it at the end, the optics don't look too good, mm-hmm. realizing at the end, says, well, yeah, I think you guys do, you know, deserve a chance. You let them, you put them on a hook, and you kept them out there at sea, hoping that a shark was going to eat them alive. And then when you pull the bait back in, you're like, oh, boy, we just won a championship, and I still got my bait on. You caught the fish, and you still have the bait, and you're like, oh, boy, what the hell do I do now? Oh, hey, maybe I'll give you guys an opportunity to get back on the hook again. By then, it was already over. By then, listen, if Krause's credibility was ruined with those players, at some point, Reinsdorf's credibility was ruined to those players, too. Not as much.
Too much.
Not to the degree with Krause, but certainly there was a cloud over Reinsdorf's head.
Yeah. Michael hit not one but two game-winning shots over Brian Russell. People should remember that, 97 and 98. Brian Russell learned the hard way. Don't ever talk trash about Michael Jordan. We'll play that story and a few other good things from the documentary last night coming up next.
You're listening to Carmen and Yurko on ESPN 1000. Follow at Carmen DeFalco and at Yurko64 on Twitter.
Carmen and Yurko on ESPN 1000, Chicago's home for sports.
I don't know if you all remember Andrew Hawkins, the wide receiver for the Bengals. Did he play for anybody else, Merck, or was it just the Bengals?
I've looked that up, Carm, but I bet you he did.
He's been pretty funny with the way he's sort of impersonated and spoofed The Last Dance. You know, he does that great Rodman. I mean, his Rodman is incredible. Spot on. But Merck and I, we got a kick out of his last one. But I just really love when he does his MJ impersonation. He's always chomping on this big cigar. And the line he uses, which is just great, I'm going to bust your ass, and then I'm going to give you 60. I mean, it's just, it's fabulous. And so he...
Is he the guy that played with Cleveland, Kerm?
I don't remember
him playing. He played with the Bengals, the Rams, Browns, and the Patriots.
Okay, so he did. I don't remember him being on all those teams. I just remember the Bengals.
It's Andrew Hawkins, right?
Andrew Hawkins. There you go. And you got it, Yurk.
And the Montreal Alouettes in 09 and 10.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
He's a two-time Grey Cup champion.
Oh, wow. Good for him. Well, he's funny. I mean, you should go on his Twitter because he's done these great impersonations of all the guys, and he's had some celebrity help, too, for a few of the things he's done the last couple of weeks. But Merck and I just laugh every time he does the joy. Like I said, he's got the big cigar, and, you know, I'm gonna give him 60. And so last night we got another classic. Brian Russell, who I guess turned down requests to be interviewed for
Jason
this.
Jason Hare said the only two that turned him down was Karl Malone and Brian Russell, I guess, never even responded.
So he didn't even turn down. He just never called
Brian
him
Russell
back.
Never responded,
like,
right?
Brian Russell just didn't respond.
Yes.
So here's a little story from last night about the history between MJ and Brian Russell.
We had probably... three guys that were typically assigned to match up with Michael, and Brian Russell would have been first and foremost. Brian Russell made our team in the first place through incredible effort defensively, so he earned the right to take on some of the tougher assignments, and it doesn't get any tougher than Michael.
Yeah, Brian Russell. When I was playing baseball, Utah's in town to play the Bulls. They're practicing at the facility. I go over and say hello to John and Carl. And this kid, Brian Russell, comes up to me and says, man, why you quit? Why you quit? Man, you knew I could guard your ass. I couldn't, you had to quit. I said, Carl, you need to talk to this dude, man. Nah, he's just a young rookie. But from that point on, he's been on my list.
Brian's a very playful guy, and he said things all the time. I have no doubt Michael had a number of edges that he could have sharpened for whatever reason.
I knew how he played. You know, he played on his front of his toes. Give him a head and shoulder fake, go one way, he can't stop.
They come with Shandon Anderson here to guard Scottie Pippen. They got Brian Russell on Michael Jordan. We're down to five. Jordan, Curry Lewis on Russell. We're down to two. Out of one. Here's
of course, he'd get him later, too. Should we play that? I mean, that was 97. That was game one when Michael hit that shot. He was the mid-range master, man. They just don't play that kind of basketball anymore. Kobe was probably the last to sort of carry on that legacy. He really modeled his entire game around MJ and thrived in that mid-game. But when you watch all those highlights, it's such a different thing for young kids now. Probably not what they're used to watching the NBA. So that was 97. Should I play the... I'll play this chunk, too, because this is last. Why not?
Do.
I mean, yeah, this is the last shot. I mean, this is it, right? And so then he gets Russell again a year later.
It was less than a minute to play. We're down three. Phil calls timeout.
This is a big 20-second timeout for Chicago because it allows Jordan to get some rest.
Michael Jordan, at this advanced stage of his career, has to carry the team. He has to play extra minutes in a grueling series. And that last sequence in the final half minute plus is one of the greatest sequences you'll ever see in any sport.
Now the Bulls would like to get 2-for-1 possession here. Try to get a quick score against the free throw line to give them two opportunities to one.
Pippen into Jordan. Michael working on Russell. Brings them to within one.
Michael takes it right to the rim and lays it in. So now we need a stop.
When he made a layup and he went back down, I knew they were running the patented play through Karl Malone.
He ran that play a couple times prior. And Dennis and Malone have been fighting all game. And Karl just totally forgot that I was on the weak side.
Malone is doubled. They swat at it and steal it. Michael never cleared. Malone doesn't see him. He comes from the blind side and strips him.
Now I got the ball, and I can see Phil, you know, basically out of the corner of my eye. He wasn't going to call a timeout.
If we could do something without them talking about it, working against a set defense, we'd rather go with a live ball situation.
17 seconds from game 7 or from championship number 6.
What's going through your head when you're coming back up the floor?
Get the hell out the way. Get the hell out of the way, only thing I was thinking.
I didn't even have to do it. All I did was plant myself right down there. I knew he's going to shoot this. He is not going to pass this ball. It was John Paxson or, you know, Steve Kerr. Hell no. This is his turn.
When I scoped over the floor, I felt like I can get a jump shot off or I can get all the way to the basket. So it's just a matter of me picking the right time when to attack.
Utah, 5.2 seconds left. Michael Jordan running on fumes with 45 points.
At the end of the game, you gotta get it out of his hands. He's a killer. Watch Jordan's left hand here as he gives Russell the push. Referee can't see that. Jordan frees himself up for a clean look.
Now everybody said I pushed off. The man was, his energy was going that way. I didn't have to push him that way.
Russell was already stumbling away. That hand on his backside was the equivalent of a maitre d' showing someone to their table.
When he took that shot, you could just hear the energy just get sucked right out of the building.
That may have been the last shot Michael Jordan will ever take in the NBA. If that's the last image of Michael Jordan, how magnificent is it?
And those devastated fans are just groaning, this collective groan as the Jazz take timeout.
Tired as hell. I'm exhausted, but I have one more stop.
One more stop that they would get that great finish. Remember, just kind of posing, knowing exactly what was happening. And I like what Bob Costas said. Right. That's the equivalent of a maitre d', like, you know, helping you into your chair. That wasn't much of a push-off.
Only the maitre d' doesn't tell you. I'll offer you this much. He didn't push off if Reggie Miller didn't push off either.
That's right, York. In game 4.
We're even then, right?
I mean, you could see all Brian Russell's momentum was sort of going that way.
Gentlemen, we're even. Yeah. That's all I'm saying. Reggie Miller didn't push off. Michael Jordan didn't put anything on there either.
By the way, do you guys remember in 2009, after MJ's Hall of Fame speech, in that speech he spent a minute kind of going after Brian Russell again, and Brian Russell then challenged him to a one-on-one basketball game, which he wanted to be on, like, pay-per-view TV or whatever, you know, just televise it. And then supposedly, in the articles I've been reading, MJ was the one who decided not to do it.
Really? I'm shocked at that.
Yeah. We had him on. I don't know. We had him on after that fact, and he talked about how he
Brian Russell?
Brian Russell, yeah. He was working for, like, the YMCA or some youth organization.
Like, I'm shocked that Michael wouldn't take him up on that, aren't you? That seems like a perfect opportunity.
Well, I mean, the only one bringing value there is
Michael. Yeah. What does he have to gain, I guess, at that
nothing.
Point?
Yeah. Nothing. He's the only one bringing value to the project.
That's
true. Pay-per-view.
We should discuss next also the food poisoning, if we believe.
Yeah, let's do that real quick when we come back. Yeah. He's going to bust your ass and he's going to give you 60, Merck. You better watch it. All right? If you say Michael wasn't food poisoned, he's going to give you 60, so be careful. Yeah, we could discuss that when we come back next.
This is Carmen and Yurko on ESPN 1000.
See what we're up to.
See them on Twitch at ESPN 1000 Chicago.
So for most of us, it was nothing new to hear that Michael got sick in Utah before game five in 1997 because of bad pizza. You know, it had been rumored before. Bad pie, that it had been rumored to be room service pizza. But as they told you in the documentary last night, room service had stopped serving. I've never been to Salt Lake City. I mean, Sylvie could probably talk about it. You know, he covered that three, you know, he covered the second three-peat, and he was on the road, I think, out back then. Salt Lake City might be like St. Petersburg. You know, I've been in St. Petersburg, and at 10 o'clock at night, you want food? Good luck to you. There is no food. Nothing's open. I don't know. I mean, Salt Lake might be a little bit more of a metropolis. I really don't know.
I haven't been there, Carl.
Right. I mean, but they're looking around. They can't, you know, in Chicago, you're stuck in Chicago. You want to get anything you want. It's 10:30. You get any type of food you want. In New York, California, you know, you're in a big city in California. Salt Lake City, not so much. What are you going to get? They're calling around. They find one pizza place. Now, they said Grover said five people showed up at the door, right? Grover and George were part of the documentary last night saying five delivery guys showed up at the door. How'd they know it was for Michael? Who calls and says, I'm ordering pizza for Michael Jordan?
Nobody does. You order five pizzas, they make the assumption that that's where the Bulls are staying. It's got to be for the Bulls.
But they ordered one pizza, didn't they? That's what I'm saying.
It was one pizza.
The story does have some...
I've seen people...
Why would five guys show up? Why would you think that you're delivering a pizza to Michael Jordan?
I've seen some wild thoughts out there online where people suggest that the only way the pizza restaurant had to stay open was if someone called saying... It's for someone important.
Oh, okay.
So tipping off, like, we know that the Bulls are staying at that hotel. They're calling for a pizza.
And they say,
it must be.
Right. Okay,
now, that's a wild stretch.
No, that could actually make some sense. Listen, 10:30 in Utah, at Salt Lake, you might not be able to find a place open.
Weren't they in Park City? Were they in Salt Lake City? I thought they were staying.
Wherever the hell they are.
Right? That lowers the odds.
They were staying 45 minutes outside of Salt Lake City.
I thought everybody's at the Tabernacle Choir.
I mean, the more you remove yourself from a downtown area, the less likely a place is going to stay open all night.
I'm telling you, I've been in small towns like that where at night, you know, you ever go to Hartford at 10 o'clock? You can't. There's nothing open in Hartford at 10 o'clock. You're not getting food. And so maybe that there's something to that they had to convince them, listen, this is for a bowl. And so now five guys, delivery guys, show up thinking, who's this for? Is it Scotty? Is it Phil? Is it Dennis? Could it be numero uno, MJ? And then what did they do to that pizza? That's what I'd like to know, Yurko.
Same thing that'd give you pink eye, kid. Same thing that would give you pink eye. That doesn't look like
sausage.
That going
to give you food poisoning?
Yeah, that doesn't look like sausage.
No, I guess not. And do we? I mean, we've heard that story for years. Should we believe that? Who the hell knows, guys? I really don't know. Start, you know, how do you vet something like that all these years later? Who do you start calling? I mean, you had eyewitnesses. Now, those are Jordan's inner circle. Those are his best friends. So they're not going to break bad. They're going to stick to the story. How do you start vetting that? You look for the pizza place? you start calling him, did it really? I mean, how, you know, I don't know how you vet that 22 years later.
That's hard.
Isn't it?
Yeah, that's damn near impossible.
What do you think happened, Merck? Merck's more skeptical. He was asking me this morning. He said, I don't know about the pizza story. I said,
what, do you think he got drunk? What,
well, I mean, some people have thought that.
No, I don't want to accuse him of getting drunk. I just find it crazy. I don't know what kind of pizza it was that he could get that sick from eating a pizza.
Oh, you ever have food poisoning? It's debilitating. It's brutal.
And Jason here, by the way, said this morning, actually it was last night with Jalen Rose afterwards, that Michael was upset because they had all ordered dinner without him like 2 hours before, whoever was in the room with Tim Grover and who else was there with him.
George and yeah.
Right. And so he ordered the pizza. He was hungry. And when the pizza showed up, he told them no one else is eating it. And he, I guess what Jason Harris said, he opened the pizza and spit on it.
Hmm.
So no, I guess he's done that before too with his food, that, so no one else will eat it. So he spit
he's
on
like
the
like a criminal mastermind.
Because everyone was saying, why no one else had a piece of pizza? Like a pizza shows up, what's the first thing you do? Hey, can I have a slice?
Of course, everybody eats pizza,
right?
That's
right.
I mean, good luck when you tell, you know how many times I've told myself, nah, you know, I'm going to stay away from, you can't stay away from pizza.
It's hard, especially when it's hot.
Exactly, Yerk. Oh, no, I already ate, but now you guys ordered pizza? Well, all right, I'm just saying.
Yeah, somebody orders a pizza, I walk in 20 minutes later, it's easier to say, nah, I'm not hungry, nah, no, thank you. But you got a hot pie?
Forget it.
And the cheese is still gooey? Yeah.
You got
yourself a guy that wants a piece.
Even if
MJ spit on it, I'd still want a piece.
I think I might still go after a piece, too. I don't know. I look at it. I'm at a party. It's 20 minutes later. It's an hour later. I'm still looking at it, jonesing for it. I'm like a drug addict. I keep, like, the mental willpower it takes me to say, don't have a piece. And then I always cave and I have a piece. I can't resist. I'm like, oh, no, it's too good. It's pizza. I don't know how they didn't eat it. Maybe Michael fought them off and he told them, no, you're not allowed to have any. But that's the story behind the flu game, or this, it wasn't the flu game, the food poisoning game, which, God, we've heard that story hundreds of times over the years, that's what happened. That's why he was so sick. I like the story last night of the team's last ever get-together, too. Listen to this from the end of the docuseries.
I remember there was this team meeting with Phil, and he's like, this is it.
My wife had gotten her master's in social work. And she was part of a group that went in to help people that were grieving. One of the things they did was a ritual in which they kind of put things to rest.
Do you see the way that dream?
He says, you know, this is it. This is the last dance. Last time we're ever going to be together.
Does it?
He asked everybody to bring in anything you want to write about what the team means to you.
Write what being on this team has meant to you during this year, and read it, and we'll burn it in a coffee can.
And every guy had emotional words to say. And I remember Michael actually wrote a poem.
It was a depth of emotion that you never thought he had.
You can spend your time alone.
Phil had this knack, no matter how big you are or how big you think you are, to always draw you in to be a part of the process.
Makes much
more. I'm not a poet. I just spoke what I felt at the time. We always gonna be bonded.
In the present.
You say thanks for the past. Enjoy the moment. Let's make sure we end it right.
We saw him as this bully sometimes. But that day he showed his compassion and his empathy for all of us. Then everybody put the paper in the can, and at the end of the session, Phil turned out the lights and he lit the paper in the can. One of the most powerful things I've ever seen.
Classic Phil. That was touching, and that's why maybe that calm that I was talking about earlier came over me, Yerk. I said, you know what? They're the closest thing to perfect we're going to see. You know, they walked off that floor after 6 appearances in the finals in 8 years, and they were never a loser. You know, and maybe it was just time. It was time to end. We never had to watch them lose. We never had to watch Michael sort of maybe age ungracefully. Look, it wasn't pretty when he was back in Washington. And yeah, it was a very young team, and maybe that's not fair. Michael still had a few amazing moments. If I'm not mistaken, right around New Year's Eve that first year back, he dropped 50, didn't he? He didn't drop 60, Mark, but he gave him 50. I think Michael, like, maybe it was New Year's Eve. Right around the holidays, Michael had a 50-point game, and it was like, wow, I mean, the guy could still go out and score 50. But It wasn't very pretty. I was in the building when Michael came back for the first time. The Bulls were terrible. I covered the Bulls. It was a, if memory serves, it was a Saturday afternoon, and the Bears were playing the playoff game against the Eagles that Saturday night. Is that right, guys?
The last game at Soldier Field.
That's
the
right.
Original Soldier Field.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, it was so emotional and incredible to be in there, and that game was so pitiful, not only because both teams were bad, but Michael was awful. And maybe his mind just wasn't in it. You know, maybe it was just he was too overcome with emotion from that, but it wasn't pretty. It wasn't, maybe it wasn't, you know, going out like Mays, but it wasn't pretty. And so maybe it was perfect the way we saw it end. I don't know. And
December 29th, 2001, Michael scored 51.
Yeah, so it was right before Christmas Eve, or New Year's Eve. Yeah, I remember that. All right, we'll crosstalk and put the finishing touches on our show with Waddle and Sylvie when we come back next. We're back in 2 minutes.